Hey, Ms. Crowley Jones.
All right. Okay, thank you. Ms. Podarczyk, before the break, I had directed you to the potential cross exhibit 22 that is in four parts. Were you able to locate that?
Yes, I have all four parts up on my computer.
Perfect. And I'm going to direct you to part three, which is 162 pages, and I think it begins with section 5, and ask you to go to the PDF, page 96.
So, Ms. Crowley Jones, my part three has 32 pages. Four has 170 pages.
Uh-oh.
200 pages.
Oh, no, we're working with two different documents. All right. Let me see. Can you go to the one that has 170 pages and open that up and tell me how that starts?
This one starts with a letter dated October 30th, 1978.
Okay. Can you go to about 93? Of that document? I think we're looking at two different configurations, and I hope we can get us together.
So 93 of that document, the number down at the bottom is 2-7.
Hmm. No, that's not where I'm going either. Now, the way the documents were filed, there was a bit of a misnomer there. Is there any way that you can access the way that they were provided to the commission? And
so I have it. I have someone in the room said to look at part four. If you give me, it looks like they are searchable, text searchable. So if you give me a word or a phrase, I may be able to find it by doing the text search.
Okay. If you will look for, June 26, 1978, I'm not sure it's going to pull that up.
Is that the exact phrase that I would be searching for?
Well, it's the date on the first page of the letter. If you look at, maybe you could look for his name, Colonel Height, H-I-G-H-T.
I see a, on one document is a page that says that Colonel Height was the person who signed it, and it's
okay.
The on of it of October 30th, 1978.
I'm looking for a document. Type this in: Region Roman numeral 4 of the U.S. Environmental Protection. We'll see if we can get it that way.
Let me try each one of the documents, if you give me one moment.
Ms. Crowley Jones, this is Commissioner Brown Bland. What was that number you gave early on should be at the bottom of the page?
The one that I'm looking at, there is not a number at the bottom of the page. This is actually, it begins with section 5 of the EIS, and it is a letter with a stamped date of June 26, 1978, written to Colonel Adolph A. Height.
So I was able to find it, Ms. Crowley Jones, in case others are looking for it. At least on mine, it was part one. Page 96 of 162 of the PDF.
Okay. We're the page, the PDF page 96, that we're on the same page. That's exciting. Thank you for your diligence in getting there. Have you seen this document before?
I have seen the document. It is 500 or some pages all together, but it has been some time since I've looked at it, but I have seen it one time.
Okay. And just to orient everyone, I believe this was EPA's, this portion of the document is EPA's review of the draft EIS for the Mayo Electric Generating Plant. And again, just for orientation, make sure we're all on the same page. This PDF page 96 is the first page of the letter. Page 97 is the second page of the letter and shows that it was signed by John White with an enclosure. Are we on the same page? Okay. And then starting at page 90, PDF 98, it says comments on draft EIS Mayo Electric Generating Plant. Is that correct?
Yes, I am on that page.
Okay, perfect. You testified before the break that the company has to make decisions based upon what is known at the time. This document would indicate what was known by the company at that time, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. But I also know that specifically for the Mayo EIS, there was a subsequent study that was done that is referenced as the Floyd study. And that was produced in 1979 that, again, you have to look at it in sequence and to look at the entire picture. And I do know that at the conclusion of the environmental impact statement and the evaluation for the Mayo Pond, we did receive a approval from the state agency to move forward with the construction of the Mayo Pond. And we received a NPDES for that. So we got all the approvals we needed from the state regulatory agencies and the federal regulatory agencies in order to move forward with the construction of the pond.
Okay. Now on PDF page 96, which is the first page of the letter, there's three points there. I would turn your attention to the third point regarding fly ash and bottom ash transport system. Would you please read that section beginning with water carriage?
It states for number three, fly ash and bottom ash transport system. Water carriage of fly ash and once through bottom ash sluicing systems are inconsistent with existing and expected, to be proposed in the September 1978 with re-promulgated schedule in March 1979, close parentheses. Standards of performance for new sources. It is anticipated that re-promulgated regulations will require dry fly ash handling systems and recirculating bottom ash handling systems. However, even in the absence of such requirements, such systems appear necessary to assure that chronic and acute toxicity conditions do not occur in Mayo Creek, Crutchfield Branch, and the Makeup Water Reservoir. In the absence of a commitment to the use of such systems by CP&L, the project appears environmentally unacceptable. But again, I would like to state that there's a lot of proposed new promulgations, new type of things that are going on with EPA. Great questions for Ms. Williams, who was part of EPA during this time period. And again, we received, after all the studies that we did, we received approval from all the agencies to move forward with the permitted Mayo Basin.
Okay, but looking at this language where it says inconsistent with existing standards, that's pretty clear, isn't it?
So it does state that, but it also says that there are proposals to be re-promulgated. So it is one line in one document. You have to look at the history of all that went on. So there are subsequent things that happened to this information that came out. So again, that would be, especially since this came from US EPA, great thing to follow up with Ms. Williams about.
Okay. But in 1978, Ms. Williams wasn't employed by EPA Region 4, who's commenting on this, was she?
I cannot remember exactly what years Ms. Williams was with EPA, but I will say that this is one document, one time. There's a lot of changes that were going on with EPA related to fly ash, understanding of what was going on, and she would be able to talk about that.
Okay. But in terms, you've been offered as the company's witness for historical management of coal ash, so I'm just trying to get a sense of what you think about the conclusions that were made in this document and how that might align with other historical documents that you were looking at. But thank you.
Well, and I would say, Ms. Crawley-Jones, again, this is a 500-page document, talks about the history of everything. This is one line in that document. I do know that there was additional studies. 1979 Floyd Report talked about groundwater, talked about Crutchfield Branch. The NPDES permit we received, we were required to sample out of Crutchfield Branch. So it's you have to put the whole story together.
Now, if you would go to PDF page 101, which is part of the comments that are more details about ash handling. And you see section C that says ash handling?
I do.
Okay. And the last full sentence near the bottom begins, although this requirement, referring to dry ash handling, was remanded, and then this is a quote, further evaluation by EPA has indicated that the technology of dry fly ash handling is feasible, is not excessively costly, and is being instituted by many power companies now. Did I read that correctly?
Yes, that is what the document states.
So in 1978, EPA Region 4 was recommending dry ash handling, wasn't it?
Looking at the words on the page, again, it has been 500-page document. I have not read through all of this in a very long time. It does say that further evaluation by ETA that the technology is feasible, is not excessively costable, and is being instituted. It doesn't, just by that one section, it doesn't say absolutely you have to do it. It made those three points. Again, go back to what we ended up doing at the site was approved and permitted. So one document, one item, lots of different ideas that were coming through. It says what it says, fly ash was feasible. It did not say it was required to be done at the site.
Correct. But we have been talking about, and you've been testifying as to what was prudent and reasonable, and that what the company's actions were whether they were prudent and reasonable at the time they were taken. And these are factors that were highlighted at that point.
Correct. Factors that were highlighted in one document.
Okay. All right, I'll move on. Okay, on page 61 of your testimony, you talk about the construction of ash basins. So page 61, line 22, you testify that DEP last constructed a new ash basin in 1985. Is that correct?
Yes.
And which one was that?
Give me one moment. It's been a very long week.
Let me do this, and it may help you. I'm going to refer you to Sierra Club Potential Cross Exhibit 17, which was the DEP Kieran Exhibit 5 exhibit with basic ash basin information and history.
So I actually found the other document that I was looking for. So at Cape Fear, we had the 1985 basin. And then, of course, at Sutton, we also had the basin that was the 1984 basin.
Okay. Do you know how many basins were constructed after 1978? And maybe this is the time to refer you to that Sierra Club Potential Cross Exhibit 17.
So I do have that one in front of me now.
Okay.
What was the year that you mentioned?
If you hold on just a second, Commissioner Claude Felter, we'd ask that Sierra Club potential cross exhibit 17 be marked for the record as Benarsik rebuttal Sierra Club DEP cross exhibit 3.
It will be so marked.
Okay. So my question was, how many ash basins were constructed after 1978?
So it'll probably be easier to go down the Asheville than the 1982 basin at Asheville. Mm-hmm. There was the Cape Fear, the 1985, the one that we mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then there was the 1983 at Mayo. Mm-hmm. The Mayo, that's a wrong number on there. On there, that was the, I will say that, the Mayo Basin, that is not correct. That one was constructed in around 1981 to the 1983 is when it started started operation. Sorry, I wanted to make sure I got that right. And then there is also the 1984 Sun.
Okay. Did we mention, I think, H.F. Lee Polishing Pond in 1982? Is that correct?
Yes, but that's not a basin. That's not an ash basin. That's a polishing pond.
Okay. But we did mention the Asheville 1982 basin, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So we have four new ash basins that were constructed after EPA clearly said to DEP in 1978 that wet handling was, quote, inconsistent with existing and expected regulation, correct?
Again, Ms. Crawley-Jones, after 1978, the one document you put together that you showed me had that in there. But again, all of these basins were approved for construction. I would note that the 1985 basin was approved without a liner by DEQ to move forward. So that we did get permits and approvals from our regulators to move forward.
And based on that document, the Karen Exhibit 5, it also has the tonnage there. So looking at those, we could figure out how many tons of coal ash were placed in those basins after 78. Is that fair from that document?
Yes, it does show ash in tons as of 1/17.
Okay. And
give me a moment. Ms. Benarsik, what was that date you said?
1/17/2017.
The total tonnage showed on the Curran chart, and that was for tons of fly ash placed in those basins after 78. Is that correct?
Tons of ash.
Tons of ash. Okay.
Not necessarily fly ash. It may have been also bottom ash.
Okay. All righty. Do you have a breakdown anywhere of fly ash versus bottom ash for those basins?
Not readily available. I'm trying to think even if I have one, but not that I can, as I sit here today, I can't think of one.
Okay. All right. Okay. Let's move to a different topic. On page 53 of your testimony, you talk about, you address the cost recovery for land purchases at Mayo, correct?
Yes.
And on line 16, you describe the land purchase, quote, to mitigate groundwater risk at Mayo, correct?
That is what this says.
Okay. Earlier, I think Ms. Luhr asked you about the risks that the company was hoping to mitigate by purchasing property near the Mayo Basin. Do you recall that?
I do.
And I believe you mentioned that part of the reason was to have, and I think the words you used were more of a buffer. A buffer from what?
So a buffer so we have a compliance boundary at all of our ash basins, and the compliance boundary, and Mr. Wells can go into in more detail and can also make sure I'm getting the distances right, but there's a compliance boundary. It's X number of feet away from the edge of the basin. And that is the where we have to make sure that we have groundwater inside that compliance boundary. Of course, the compliance boundary is a state item, is under CAMA. Under the federal CCR rule, groundwater has to be managed back to the waste boundary. So it's a different level there. So, and I think I mentioned in earlier testimony that we do not have 2L impacts beyond the compliance boundary at Mayo. So when you look at the why we purchased this property, there was neighbor concerns about groundwater in the area. We didn't have any impacts in that area, but when I mentioned earlier, making sure we had more distance, a little bit more of a buffer, so it helps us push out that compliance boundary, because we were able to move the property boundary out a little bit, and we can continue. We had that buffer area to make sure, as we're continuing to monitor, that we had enough distance that if something were to show up in the future or anything different happened, we have that full compliance boundary. And again, Mr. Wells can talk about also that purchase in more detail related to anything with groundwater.
Okay, but in general, can you describe where the property was located that was purchased at Mayo? Was it along the Crutchfield branch?
I do know, Ms. Crawley-Jones, that it is on the northern side of the site, closest to the Virginia border. As I sit here today, I can't picture exactly where it is in relationship to the Crutchfield branch, but I do know it's on that northern side, closer to the Virginia border.
Okay. I want to refer you to Hart Exhibit 54, which was entered as AGO Benarsik Direct Cross Exhibit 10. And this is the CAM report from Mayo. And it's got some sources in there that I think can help us a little bit on this piece.
I do have that in front of me now.
Okay. And if you could go to page 51. And I believe you'll see
Miss Crawley-Jones, mine doesn't have it, since I'm looking off of the hard copy. If there's a number at the bottom,
that okay. Have,
there's also a number of attachments, so that may also help to the attachment.
Right. I'm getting to the PDF itself, and then let me see how I can find. It's the map. It's the first site map, and I believe it follows after attachment B, if that helps. Maybe figure 1-2.
I have that in front of me now.
Great. So just to orient everyone, we've been talking about the compliance boundary. Would that be the purple dashed line on that map?
Yes.
And then does this help? Is that northern property outside the compliance boundary towards the Virginia border? Is that your understanding of the property that was purchased?
Yes.
Okay. And then just to get a little bit of orientation, monitoring well 16 is the set of monitoring wells that's in that located adjacent to Crutchfield Branch and in that purchased property. Is that correct?
I do see Monitoring Well 16S, the pair. So there's a SD and 16BR. What I don't have on here is the property borders, and I'm sorry, I do not, based upon this, can tell you if that's inside or outside without seeing a map with the property borders. I'm sorry, okay. I can't remember.
But subject to check, that's a well off outside of the compliance boundary on the Crutchfield branch. Can we agree on that piece?
It is a well outside the compliance boundary as shown on this drawing, and then also it appears to be on a stream, and that would be Crutchfield branch.
Okay. And in that 1978 document, EPA stated in that same EIS that they did not believe that the use of the proposed pond for ash disposal was an acceptable use of Crutchfield branch, and that would be what was dammed here for the creation of the ash basin. Is that correct?
Yes, but I would also state that and I'm trying to pull up the 1979 Floyd report, it actually references the Crutchfield branch and what came out of that 1979 evaluation. Mr. Wells may be able to pull it up better than I can, because he has information on this. But I also do know that the NPDES permit included sampling within Crutchfield branch. And that was how the department looked at it and said, this is a sampling point, an important sampling point. And Mr. Wells has more information about that NPDES permit and those samples.
Okay. And I believe you've testified a couple of times now that there were no exceedances beyond the compliance boundary at Mayo. Is that correct?
At Mayo, we are not having to do a extraction system or extraction treatment at Mayo because there are none. We've had four quarters, and that is what we provided to the agency that shows we do not have impacts beyond the compliance boundary. What I don't know, as I sit here today, again, better question for Mr. Wells, if at any time there is any type of hit in one of those wells, but I do know we do not have to do any type of groundwater correction action to pull a plume back into the compliance boundary.
Okay. So based upon those four quarters, but you're not testifying that there's never been an impact to the Crutchfield branch or groundwater related thereto.
I think if I haven't made myself clear,
it's
related to what is required under CAMA. And looking at background information, Mr. Wells has more detail on that, but I do know that we do not have to do a groundwater corrective action to pull a plume back inside the compliance boundary because we do not have a plume that's outside that compliance boundary.
Okay. Just again, for orientation.
Excuse me, Mr. Marzo, we've lost your video.
I keep having the wrong finger slide over with this new setup. Sorry about that.
I've been having the same problem. I wanted to make sure you were still with us.
Yep.
Go ahead. I'm sorry for the interruption.
No worries. Looking back at the map, we've identified MW16, the set, and then MW3, that's a monitoring well that is inside of the compliance boundaries, correct?
Based upon this drawing, which is really small, I don't know if it's right at the compliance boundary or inside or right outside. Mr. Wells may know specifically where that is, but I would have to have a much bigger picture to be able to see where that is. It appears to be placed either right on top of the compliance boundary, so I don't know if it's inside or out.
Okay. And I'm not sure you've got a hard copy, but on the digital copy, the next page begins reporting out various data from the groundwater monitoring. Would you agree with me that on these sheets, yellow indicates exceedances?
Yellow is an exceedance of the 2L standard.
Okay. And go one more page in, because I believe the next, it's PDF page 53, but it's the next page of data is where you find the results for MW3 for those four quarters.
I do see MW3.
Okay. And when you look there, there are exceedances for boron. Generally, boron is not a naturally occurring substance, correct?
So it is not. But again, I would also say that although this says look with respect to groundwater flow direction, down gradient, and saprolite, you need to look and see where it is. And we already talked about, I don't know if that's one's inside or outside. And it also does not take into account any type of background. So I would say that I would go back to, I know in working with the agency, looking at background, looking at what we have provided to them, we do not have to pull any type of plume back inside of a compliance boundary at Mayo. Looking at these, again, Mr. Wells may have more detail, but that is a fact that I know with the agency today.
Okay. And I'm just trying to get a high level understanding of some of this, and I'm not trying to get into the weeds, but tip my understanding and just trying to make sure that boron is one of those indicators of a plume, of a coal ash related plume. Is that correct?
Yes. And actually, we used boron when we did our modeling that we submitted to the state with our groundwater corrective action plans. We used boron, I believe, and again, Mr. Wells will know for sure whether or not, I believe we used boron as kind of our key of what we would look at when we did our modeling.
Okay. And it's subject to check. I know you had a small map, but I'll represent the Monitoring Well 3 is inside the compliance boundary. So I'm not suggesting that this is an indication outside there, but inside the compliance boundary, right on Crutchfield Branch, this page 53 does show exceedances of 2L for boron. Is that correct?
So based upon the document, the document shows what the document shows. But again, I would go back to discussions with the agencies where we are today. We do not have to do groundwater corrective action plan to bring anything back inside of a compliance boundary.
And I get that. I understand that. You've been very clear on that. But that also Monitoring Well 3 also shows exceedances inside the compliance boundary for manganese and vanadium, correct?
Of the 2L standard, what I don't know is what the background standard is for those constituents.
Okay. And then if you go to the next page, which is 54, you have to go, it's kind of the bottom of the middle third of the data sheet. I believe that's where you start seeing the results for Monitoring Well 16, which we agreed was outside the compliance boundary. Do you see those?
Yes, and actually in here it says off Duke property, but again, that's based upon this time frame, and I'm not sure if that was inside the property we purchased or not, but it does say off Duke property. And so that goes off Duke property. It's outside the compliance.
And the sampling dates there are what you suggested, the four quarters from July of 2018 to April of 2019. And you see those?
I do.
And granted, it is not an exceedance, but do you see for MW16S, the saprolite shallow wells, that boron is showing up in that well?
I do see that, and that's actually why we will continue to monitor. And
okay.
It is something that, of course, we will do. It's not like we will stop. We will continue to monitor and work with the agency if anything were to change in the groundwater.
Okay. And then do you also see that there is a 2L exceedance for iron in 16S?
Yes, but I would go back to, this is just showing 2L exceedances. It does not do any indication of background. And when you look at, with 2L, you also have to look at background at the end of the day. So this is a straight comparison with 2L from what I can tell. Again, Mr. Wells may be able to provide more clarity, but you also, of course, have to take into account background levels.
Okay. And there was additional groundwater monitoring data that was presented as part of the comprehensive site assessments for these sites, including Mayo, wasn't there?
Yes, there was a lot of groundwater data that was provided.
Some of that beginning as early as 2015 from Mayo. With that, would you be surprised? Subject to check, sampling data from 2015 through 2017 is available in addition to the four quarters that are shown on this particular exhibit.
Mr. Wells will be able to tell you the years for groundwater data, all the data that we have, all the groundwater data has been provided to the agency. It was also, of course, provided to all the interveners.
Okay. And so the documents will show what the documents will show relative to exceedances for pH, cobalt, manganese, and boron, or there's not a 2L exceedance for boron, but for pH, cobalt, and manganese in these well 16. So if that's there, and you said you didn't have knowledge of those particulars, and that would be something for Mr. Wells, correct?
Yes, that is a good question for Mr. Wells.
Okay. Now, are you aware that DEQ concluded that the groundwater plume of boron at concentrations above 2L standards had migrated beyond the compliance boundary and had reached Crutchfield Branch?
I do know, and I testified this the other day. I can't remember which of the interveners asked me this question about the April 1st, 2019 order from DEQ for excavating and the fact that it did have in there an indication that there was a plume outside the compliance boundary. And I believe I also discussed that was part of our filing with the Office of Administrative Hearing, and specifically we called out that we do not have impacts beyond the compliance boundary. So anything beyond that related to groundwater, again, Mr. Wells is the talk to with groundwater.
Okay. And that same document that I think you referenced that's been, it's now marked as Benarsik Rebuttal AGO DEP Cross-Examine. Number two, but that is that April 1st order. Were you aware that DEQ also concluded in there that manganese and strontium were detected more than 500 feet beyond the compliance boundary?
Again, Ms. Crawley-Jones, that was all part of one of the multiple reasons all laid out in our filing against the administrative, to the Office of Administrative Hearing. In our response to those orders, and there was information related to groundwater, no matter what the constituent is, related to the compliance boundary, specifically at Mayo.
And so the company just disagreed with DEQ's conclusion about the groundwater data submitted. Is that correct?
I would point to the Office of Administrative Hearing, what our filing was. We have had, I did talk to our groundwater experts in that area and asked them, this is what the April 1st order said, what did the conversations with the agency, did they know? And based upon the conversations I have had with Duke Energy subject matter experts who had discussions with DEQ at that time, is that it was clear the information was that we did not have exceedances beyond background, beyond 2L, beyond the compliance boundary. Now, of course, DEQ had what DEQ had in their document. And we, of course, disagreed with that. And that is why we ended up having the order, or why we went back and went to the Office of Administrative Hearing But again, I would go back to today, working with the agency, we do not have to bring any type of contaminant plume back inside of a compliance boundary at this at Mayo.
The conclusion that DEQ reached about there having been impacts past the compliance boundary was based upon the data that the company reported to DEQ in its comprehensive site assessments, wasn't it?
And the reason we ended up contesting that is because what came out in that order, we looked at it and said that is not correct. And subsequently, where we are today is we do not have to bring anything. There is nothing outside that compliance boundary we have to bring back. I think all those documents speak for themselves. I don't know what DEQ was thinking when they were putting that together, but I do know where we are today related to groundwater at Mayo, related to the compliance boundary. Anything on groundwater, again, I think I said it a couple times, Mr. Wells is a good person to also talk about this.
In 1978, the environmental impact statement warned against using Crutchfield Branch to construct an ash basin. And it turned out, based upon DEQ's conclusions, that warning was correct because there ultimately ended up being impacts to Crutchfield Branch. Wasn't that information known to the company at the time? And you've mentioned the Floyd report a number of times. Doesn't it appear now looking back that Floyd was wrong?
I would say no, I don't agree with you. I found the Floyd report. I have it in front of me. The very last page in the Floyd report says it is difficult to imagine that any significant adverse impacts on the groundwater aquifer could be caused by ponding of the ash waters at the proposed site. That was one I was able to pull up quickly. I would say our groundwater data today and what we have to do related to our compliance boundary aligns with what this is. And then any other questions you have on groundwater, please refer to Mr. Wells.
All right. I have no further questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Crawley-Jones. These are the only parties that I have any reservation or cross-examination. So let me ask for the record, are there any other interveners or parties who have questions for Ms. Bednarczyk at this time? If not, Mr. Marzo, we'll come back to you for a redirect.
Thank you, Commissioner Kleinfelter. Just a few questions. I'll start probably from the back and move forward. Ms. Bednarczyk, you were just asked several questions by Ms. Crawley-Jones regarding Mayo and the EIS in particular. And I think you did said you had the corals report in front of you now. Not the corals report, I'm sorry, the 1979 report in front of you now. Edwin Floyd report.
I have that in front of me, at least the main document. I don't know if there was attachments, but the main document I have in front of me.
And I heard you read a portion of that, and I want to make sure that we understand, for clarity's purposes, that we're talking about the same portion of that report. Can you reference page 14 of that report? Is that?
So I was actually talking about the next page, but I'm on page 14 now.
Okay, if you see the first full paragraph on that page?
Yes, I do.
Would you mind reading the first full sentence, which goes a few lines down?
Soil conditions at the proposed ash pond site at the Mayo Electric Generating Plant are adequate to provide excellent protection to the groundwater aquifer, both in preventing significant leakage from the pond and in reducing the concentrations of the heavy minerals by filtration before the leachate reaches the aquifer.
Okay, thank you. So a very different opinion than what Ms. Crawley-Jones was talking about in the 1978 report, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and I think you mentioned subsequent to that EIS draft that the ultimate received permits for a ash basin at Mayo. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I think Ms. Crawley-Jones asked you a number of questions around industry standard and your understanding of industry standard. Let me ask you, is one way of understanding industry standard, understanding the common practices that are occurring across the industry with your yes. peers?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And are you, you're familiar with the Bonaparte Report, correct?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And the Bonaparte Report identifies at least four states within Region 4 of EPA, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And are there a number of unlined basins that were in existence even up to the point in time the CCR rule was put in effect?
Yes, there were.
Okay. So following the EIS report that Ms. Crawley-Jones showed you, there were still a common practice across the industry to use unlined basins for sluicing ash. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And for the record, Commissioner Claude Felter, just to make sure the record's clear, the report that I identified, I'd like to have it marked, which is the 1979 Edwin Floyd report for the evaluation of the potential for contamination of the groundwater aquifer by leachate from the coal ash storage pond at the Mayo Electric Generation Plant site. I'd like to have that marked as Bendarcik Rebuttal DEP Redirect 1.
It will be so marked.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Just a few more questions, Ms. Bendarcik. Now, you were asked several questions by Ms. Jost regarding the Asheville plan, and I think she asked you a number of questions about the potential to build a landfill at that facility in the prior period of time, back in that 2015 or so time frame. You call those?
Yes.
And did the commission already opine on whether it was feasible to develop a landfill at Asheville in that time period?
Yes, in the time period that Mr. Caron talked about. Yes.
Okay. Did the commission find in Duke Energy Progress's last rate case order that the Mountain Energy Act effectively made construction of a new on-site CCR landfill technically infeasible during the development of the combined cycle?
Yes, that is my recollection.
Now, you're proposing to build a landfill today that won't be completed until 2021. Is that right?
The current schedule is that we will be submitting and hopefully starting to be able to put ash in that landfill at the end of January, beginning of February of 2021.
Okay. And does that change the fact that no on-site landfill at Asheville could have been reasonably developed from September 1st, 2017 to December 31st, 2019?
It does not change the fact. It takes a number of years to put together packages, get permits, build all of that together. We are doing it, of course, for the 1.3 million ton landfill. We started construction right after the combined cycle was done and cleared the area so we could have it. And we're moving really quick for a small landfill.
And that was my next question, which was the combined cycle was complete and the coal plant was shut down at that point. Is that right?
Yes. And actually, it's actually very interesting to note because I'm also over our demolition group. In order to build that new landfill, we had to quickly move the coal yard and get that clean so that they could utilize the coal yard, which was, of course, in operation when the coal plant was operating, had to have that nice and clean so that they could use some of the fill dirt as they're building the landfill, putting it inside of the coal yard area. So it really has been like a domino effect to make sure we utilize the area appropriately.
And by phasing that work, have you created an opportunity to save customers by being able to pursue an on-site landfill at this point?
Yeah, so by doing the 1.3 million ton landfill on site, in our evaluation, we are looking at a $20 to $30 million dollar savings for our customers and for the company.
Now, Ms. Jost also asked you some questions about char, and I think I can ask these without eliciting any confidential information. Because she asked you primarily about the Sanford coal mine. And I just want to ask you, did CHAR purchase that mine to undertake the contract?
Yes.
Okay. And are there obligations that CHAR has now that it's assumed by virtue of purchasing a mine that it has ongoing obligations related to that?
Yes.
Okay. And is the fulfillment fee in part intended to address what are ongoing obligations for essentially buying a mine and that mine not being used, but still having the obligations to address that mine environmentally and otherwise?
Yes.
Okay. And Commissioner Clodfelter had indicated earlier today that he had punted a question to you, and I was just going to ask you regarding the cost breakout for Sutton and Roxboro for the corrective action necessitated by exceedances of the 2L standards beyond the compliance boundary. He asked you to try to figure out if you could break out cost data, and that was sort of termed a homework assignment. And I'm going to ask you, did you do your homework?
Yes, I did. I reached out to the accounting group, the person actually Mr. Doss referenced this morning, because I took that down as a homework assignment, not as something for Mr. Doss. So we did reach out and ask. And really, when we talk about groundwater and what may have had happened, what we may have had to do under the 2L standards related to groundwater around the basins, we don't know where we sit today what we would have had to do. The corrective actions or what would have happened under the groundwater, under 2L by itself, there's a lot of different ways we could have worked with the agencies to move forward. We don't know what we would have had to do if we would have had to put in the wells that we had to under CAMA and CCR or not, the number of wells, what would have happened. So once CAMA and CCR came along, it really, the door was closed on just under 2L and the prescriptive, the requirements, the groundwater requirements, the sampling, the assessment under CAMA and CCR are very prescriptive. And Mr. Wells didn't talk about that in more detail. But when I discussed it with our accounting people, as soon as CAMA and CCR came around, their asset retirement obligations in those, it's all tied together. And because of the requirements under CAMA and CCR related to groundwater, which is tied all with the asset and the retirement of the basins, are all tied together. So you really can't look at it and say, well, what would have only been under 2L versus CAMA and CCR? As soon as that happened, the accounting people said 2L is kind of gone. It's not gone. We still, of course, comply with 2L, but the actions that we have to take are CAMA and CCR.
And I think you said that that's because CAMA and CCR are prescriptive. Is that what you termed it as?
Yes, they're more prescriptive. Of course, CAMA has the compliance boundary requirements related to groundwater. CCR has a different compliance boundary. You have, it's at the waste boundary, which is a lot closer than the compliance boundary. So you have to put all of that together, different requirements required underneath those new obligations.
Okay, so trying to compare what you have done for 2L rules and CCR is very different because you got a prescriptive requirement on one hand, you don't on the other hand with the 2L rules. Is that generally correct?
With 2L, we don't know what would have happened with underneath 2L by itself. Where we sit today is we have to comply with CAMA and CCR.
Thank you, Ms. Bedarsik. Commissioner Clawfelter, that's all the redirect I have.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Marzo. Let me tell you what I'm going to propose to do. We are right about at 2:30. I'm going to vary a little bit our adjournment time for this reason. I'm going to give my colleagues a chance over the weekend to collect their thoughts. This is the last time we'll get to talk to Ms. Bednarsik, at least in this series of rate cases. And it might be useful for the commissioners just to have a little bit of time to reflect and be sure we get everything in the last minute. So I'm going to hold commissioners' questions over. Ms. Bednarsik, unless you were planning on taking a long vacation starting on Monday, I hope that won't disrupt you too much. But I don't think we'd finish with you anyway. I think you're likely to have enough commissioner questions and then people wanting to ask you about it where we probably wouldn't finish anyway. So with that said, I'm going to hold commissioner's questions and we'll pick up with those on Monday. And perhaps that might even enable us to focus them a little more tightly and get you through quicker. Mr. Marzo, if that's okay. Let me then address one other issue. Ms. Crawley-Jones, can you come back? Are you around?
I am.
All right. Let me just have you think about this also over the weekend. I'm going to make a suggestion, and I've asked the court reporter to consider this as well, but I want to ask it of you. With respect to your rebuttal cross-examination exhibit number 2, that's the EIS that was served in electronic form, I'm going to suggest that the way we bring that into the record when you are ready to move it is that in the record, in the actual transcript, we simply have a reference to the hyperlink to the website, but that we also then ask you if you would provide the court reporter copies of the pages, the hard copy pages that you and Ms. Bednarczyk specifically called out of that larger document discussed. And if the court reporter tells me I'm not crazy in doing that, I'm going to suggest that might be the most efficient way to handle that exhibit when it's ready to come into the record. So if you'll think about that, and Mr. Marzo will too, if you'll think about that also, I think that may be the best way to get that document wrangled into the record, as it were, since it's so massive.
I appreciate that. I had a note that we needed to address that issue, so you were reading my mind. Thank you so much.
I'm trying to keep up with you, and as I say, that'll give you something to think about over the weekend. So let me ask the parties, is there any other administrative or procedural matter that we might usefully take up here in a few remaining minutes?
Commissioner Klonfelter.
The exhibit policeman has returned. Mr. Mehta.
This is not a police matter. At least I don't think so. With respect to the EIS document.
Yes.
Assuming the document is moved into evidence, the entire document will be in evidence. Is that correct?
Well, it would be, yes.
Okay. I think that was my confusion as to what, as the entire document, as opposed to the handful of pages that were actually discussed.
I think that's correct. And what I'm suggesting really is that how the transcript reflects that fact is to have the hyperlink in the transcript and then the hard copy pages, but that the entire document is actually in the record of the case. I'm trying to avoid having to have our court reporter have to copy a 500 plus page document and then have to manage that. So that also reduces rate case expense, Mr. Mehta.
a very good outcome there, Commissioner Klonfelter. And we have managed to kill probably a small forest at this point. Paper copies of everything, so I am all in favor of that. I just wanted to be sure that the entire document was in evidence.
The entire document will, and the record will so reflect, so that for purposes, should there be subsequent proceedings in the case and there's a need to refer to other portions of the document, for example, the entire document will be considered part of the record.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Klonfelter. I appreciate it.
Mr. Robinson, I see you reappear. Is there something you want to take up?
No, Commissioner Klonfelter, I just wanted to confirm there was nothing. However, the company will provide an update on late filed exhibits on Monday. So we'll be able to give the commissioner a roadmap as to what's still outstanding and when it will be.
That's great. As we've been proceeding through the afternoon, Mr. Robinson, I've also been having some exchanges with commission staff. And I think you should anticipate, if you haven't already done so, that we'll make the following request if we haven't done so. Whenever in the Duke Carolinas case, there was a request for a late filed exhibit that would contain data or compilations pertinent to Duke Carolinas, you will very likely get a parallel request so that the information is pertinent and compiled as to Duke progress. So we'll be tracking parallel on those late filed exhibit requests. If we haven't officially done that, we'll probably do that at the end of the close of all the evidence, but you might go ahead and anticipate it if you want to do so. And that'll just move us that further, much further down the road.
Will do. Thank you, sir.
Okay. All right. If that is, if that's good for the day, then we will recess for the weekend. And remember again, we're reconvening on Monday at 1:30 PM. All right. Thank you. Everyone have a good weekend. Please turn off your mics and stop your video.